I'm joined by Shashank Joshi, research fellow at the Royal United Services Institute. Shashank, I wanted to talk to you about this New York Times piece about some sort of task force from the US being sent to Jordan. How significant do you think this is?
Well, I think some of it's signalling. Some of it is signalling not only to the Assad regime, but also to others, that the US is engaging in contingency planning. And it's not entirely brand new information. We did have reports earlier this year that the US was using its Green Beret special forces to train their Jordanian counterparts in the seizure and handling of chemical weapon stocks. But the new aspect of this story is really the fact that it's a very specific number of people, it's 150, and that it's not only to deal with chemical weapons, it's also to deal with the potential establishment of a buffer zone on Syrian soil.
How credible do you think that is? The piece also talks about them helping Jordan with refugees rather than contingency planning so much.
I think it's a very credible piece. I think that the Jordanian armed forces are very well trained, but they would probably need more American assistance in protecting themselves against any escalation that occurs than the Turkish armed forces would, who of course, you know, have a little more experience in these issues. There's a long history of U.S.-Jordanian cooperation, and there's a real concern about the fact that Jordan is a much more fragile country in political terms than Turkey is, much less equipped to handle refugees and much less equipped to bear the political strain of having these potentially big flows of people, potential changes in Jordan's own demography occurring in this way at a time when they are essentially cycling through various prime ministers and their governments are falling one by one. So the U.S. is very, very concerned that if there's a similar escalation on the southern border of Syria as that which has now occurred on the north, that it does not lead to real political fragility and transformation in Jordan itself.
Does this represent an escalation of U.S. involvement?
I wouldn't call it an escalation. It's a trickle of forces. 150 a task force of 150 is not very substantial, but it does mean really that the U.S. is less likely to be caught off guard. It does mean also the Jordanians can be a little more comfortable in their ability to deal with the situation. It's an escalation in the sense that there would potentially be some U.S. forces in harm's way, although I think they would mostly be assisting with logistics and other forms of rear area operations. I think if we're talking about the seizure of chemical weapons, which the New York Times article does refer to, those forces are probably very specific special operations forces that have anyway been considering these sorts of contingencies for the last year or so. And in that respect, this isn't an escalation, because I'm sure that those forces have been thinking through these contingencies for a long time now.
Do you think something like this is already underway in Turkey also?
The deployment of special forces, you mean?
Mm.
Yeah, I think it's safe to say that both the U.S. intelligence community and special operations community has been keeping a very close eye on how Turkish and Gulf agencies are liaising with and assisting the Syrian rebels, mostly for the purposes of intelligence, to know who's getting the weapons, who's getting the assistance, but also to lay the groundwork for their own types of assistance if the political order comes through that the U.S. will be arming and assisting rebels in other ways. And as part of that process, I think it's very likely there are U.S. Special forces also considering what they would have to do to assist the CIA in that contingency. But I think, you know, Jordan is a slightly different situation in that the task for Jordan is also to stop the violence spilling over into itself. It's a much, much weaker country than Turkey is in that respect.
As you say, the talk of buffer zones is being talked of in terms of contingency. What needs to change for some form of buffer zone to be set up?
I think the biggest trigger would be the same sort of thing we've seen on Syria's northern border, which is a cross-border incident turns into something much bigger. You know, the week of violence we've seen between Turkey and Syria was precipitated by a shell that killed a number of civilians on Turkish soil, and a combination of large amounts of public pressure on the Erdogan government, as well as an opportunistic exploitation of the situation led to this Turkish escalation. But, you know, Turkey would only have done so knowing full well that the U.S. was standing right behind it. I think the similar situation, across border act of shelling that kills very large numbers of Jordanians, would be one trigger. The other trigger would be a sudden escalation in refugee flows. And that could occur if we see the re-intensification of fighting in the south. It's so far calmed down a little bit. The flood of refugees has attenuated slightly. But if that goes back up and the Jordanians find they are simply unable to handle that number of refugees, that's when the contingency plans for a buffer zone may kick in. And that could occur if there's a sudden collapse of Syrian armed forces in the south, if there's a sudden challenge from rebels in the south that sort of takes the battle back to the army. So any number of those contingencies could call for the buffer zone.
Do you think we're going to see any change of approach on Syria after the US presidential elections, either if Obama is re-elected or if the more hawkish Mitt Romney comes in?
Yeah, I think in both cases there are indications that the US may become more assertive. We know perfectly well the US has told some of the rebel liaison outfits that we are severely constrained before the US election. We don't want to see we don't want to take overly risky acts, and we're somewhat loath to supply weapons when we don't know what happens to them. So I think it's likely there will be, if things haven't changed and we still see a sort of stalemate, there's likely to be an escalation, whether from a Romney administration or a second Obama administration. I think the mood is slowly building up. But I think there's two points to bear in mind. First of all, there is still no appetite for an armed intervention. I think that's true even under a Romney administration or a second re-elected Obama administration. And the second point is many of the factors that underlie restraint are still going to be present after the elections. And chief amongst those is a lack of faith in rebel cohesion and rebel the integrity of the rebel factions. That is, the knowledge that the FSA will be able to hold off challenges from other groups and that the rebels themselves won't disintegrate into squabbling factions. So that concern will still be there, and I think it will act as a very significant brake on the types of weaponry or assistance that flows to the rebels, even in 6 or 7 months' time.
Any sign Have you detected that the rebels are beginning to address that?
Well, they're certainly addressing it in nominal terms. You know, we saw how the FSA in near Aleppo and in northern parts of the country has become more aware of the need to form unified military councils, because they've explicitly been told that such councils are a prerequisite for getting U.S. assistance. I mean, that was in The Guardian's own excellent story a couple of weeks ago. The problem is, how do we distinguish these nominal changes, these superficial changes in structure, from actual changes in chain of command? That is, are we certain that a given rebel group in a district near Aleppo is actually reporting and responsible to someone higher up with a fixed chain of command that goes all the way up, rather than just changing its name? And, you know, a common joke is increasingly that some of these groups are individual rebel battalions are changing their names, even just to sort of induce greater assistance from foreign backers, whether that's more religious names or more evocative names. So I think the challenge for those deliberating as to whether they should escalate assistance is, how do we really know what's changing on the ground? And I think really that's what sort of underlies some of the intelligence present in southern Turkey we've seen reported on the American side. They, you know, I think what they lack most at this point is a steady, reliable flow of information. And simply having, you know, journalistic accounts from those embedded with the rebels isn't enough for them, because it really doesn't tell you, you know, what's going on. Because the rebels, of course, have every incentive to insist that things are changing, that they're more unified, that they are, you know, acting with a clear chain of command. But how do you verify that information? And I think for that, the Americans and others are still heavily dependent on listening to the Turks, which means that they are one arm's remove, which they won't like at all.
Okay, Shashank, thanks very much.
Sure, no problem.